The Saturday Night Live Friday Night Speaker Meeting held at El Paseo Shopping Center, Room 120 in San Jose, California, on February 28, 1992. Tonight's 10-minute speaker is Richard A., and the main speaker is TJP from Campbell. This recording and its copy are at the Saturday Night Live Tape Library. Please do not play this recording for commercial or entertainment purposes. Please do not break the anonymity of the speakers or any AA member at the public level. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Richard Ackerman. I'm a very grateful alcoholic. And I want to welcome the 16 newcomers, the 3 visitors, and the 30 court cards, or attendance verification, whatever you want to call it. I got into this room because I had at the time they call them court cards, and because I didn't think I had a problem, and thank God somebody did, because I didn't think I belonged here, and I came to find out that I did, and you know, I was different from you. I had what I called a 1506, and for anybody that doesn't know, that's 3502s, you know. See, I had to be different, you know. Then he changed my DUIs, and I got one of those. And I figured I'm an equal opportunity drunk, so I'll get one of those too. I was AWOL twice in the service, and was all over alcohol, you know. I call myself an alcoholic, but I've done all the other stuff. I've done uppers, downers, grass, coke, crack, you know. I did it all. The one I like that got me there the fastest was alcohol, so I call myself an alcoholic. But I'll do anything that's put in front of me. And I don't remember my first meeting. I don't remember what was said. But I do remember walking back to my car, and I was crying because I wanted what you people had. You know, when I first came in here, I thought you guys were all nerds and stuff, and you didn't have any clue what was going on. And the longer I stayed here, I found out that I didn't have any idea what was going on. And the longer I stay here, the less I know. And, you know, a lot of people, at least it seemed like for me, that a lot of people came in here, they already know who they are. And second of all, they got a drug and alcohol problem. And so we go through a lot of pain, and we have to find out who we are. And I think the best way to do that is through the steps. See, I'm nervous. I never thought I'd say that up here at the podium, but I am. You know, I got a little 8-year-old. He calls me daddy and thinks the world of me. And I wasn't a person that to be looked up to before I came into this room. See, I did all those things. I'm the alcoholic of the third chapter variety. You know, I did all the switch from rum to bourbon and beer to wine, and I did all those things, you know. I've been to jail numerous times, you know. I remember when I first came into the room, you know, I heard a lot about fear of failure, and I couldn't understand that, you know, because I know how to fail. You know, you put your stumbling block out there, you hit the son of a bitch, and you fail. I've been doing that successfully for 27 years, you know. And see, I had fear of success. When I was close to being successful, I would sabotage myself, always. And I don't do that today. You know, I used to think that failure is the worst thing in the world. And I've revised that. I saw something in a newspaper about a month ago, and it said failure is not the worst thing in the world. The worst thing in the world is having not tried. So, you know, I don't put up walls in front of myself anymore. I used to put up walls all the time, you know. And I try something, you know, before I say I can't do that. And if I hit a wall, that's okay, because at least I tried. And I came up against that wall. And my life is good today, you know. I opened the door to success, just a crack, but at least I open it. I have, I remember when I first walked in this room, you know, how fearful I was, and I used to say jokingly that I was born in a state of confusion, and I live in a state of fear, and I didn't know how true that was. And my life was based on fear. And I'm glad I saw that. I had a spiritual awakening in this room. And I've stayed here. I don't have to keep coming back. I live AA today, and I fit my life around AA. Because it's given me a life. It's given me things today that I didn't think I would have. My word is my bond today. I have things called responsibility, ethics, morals, honesty. I've got my family back. There was a point in time when my brother didn't even want to know that we were related, never mind being seen with me. And he called me up just before Thanksgiving, and he said, "What are you doing for Thanksgiving?" And I told him my mother was going on vacation, and my sister was going to Tahoe. And he said, "Good, it's not a reason why you can't come down and see me." And he sent me a plane ticket. And my brother loves me, you know. And you can't take that away from me, but I can. All I have to do is pick up that first drink. So you 16 newcomers, welcome home. Welcome home. This is the only place I've ever felt like where I was at home. You know, in the King James Version, I believe it is, there's a definition for salvation, and that is to come home. And I've come home, and I belong in this room. You know, I did all this stuff out there, you know. I don't have to go out and do that anymore. I don't want to feel the way I feel. And I look to the people, I look to the winners in this program, and every single one of the winners that I've seen has what I want. And it's one thing that runs through every one of their lives. They have a God that loves them and takes care of them. And that's what I want. So I do what they do so I can get what they get. Because I don't want to get my whole life back. So the newcomers, just keep coming back. Just, you know, if you don't hear something today, here, you know, come back to another meeting. Everything you hear up here is going to be an opinion. You know, if it's not in the book, don't believe it. I said I was never going to be a big book thumper, and I am. And I did a complete and thorough third step. I had one word in there. I turned my will and my life completely over the care of God as I understand Him. And my life almost immediately started getting better. And it wasn't my fault. And I love this program. I love these people in this room. You know, the newcomers are the most important people in here. And you're the reason we're here. You're the reason we're here. Because there was somebody here when I got in the door. And, you know, reach out to somebody. Reach out to your neighbor. And just say hello. And, you know, I have my sponsees, you know, and I tell them to get phone numbers and stuff. And I tell them to call us, you know, just take a day and just say, "Hi, I'm practicing reaching out." And just reach out, you know. Because when you come to that one point in time, when you have no mental defense against that first pill, drink, or fix, you're going to have to reach out to somebody. And I did. And there was somebody there for me. So get phone numbers, you know, get a sponsor. Do the steps. You know, go to meetings. So I have to go to meetings. I have to know that people feel exactly the way I feel. That they're going through the same type of things that I'm going through. And if they're not committing suicide, because suicide is the ultimate solution to a temporary problem. And so I have to know people are going through what I'm going through and feeling what I'm feeling. So, yeah, because when I first came into this room, if they said, "Is there anybody from Mars?" I would have held up my hand because I did not belong. I wasn't human, you know. I couldn't feel my feelings. And I can feel my feelings today. And when I'm sad, I cry. And when I'm happy, I laugh. And I couldn't do that before. You know, I had to be macho, whatever the hell that means. And I'm not that way today, you know. I'm human. And I'm proud to be human. And I can understand when people say I'm hurting. And I say, you know, just say, "Do you want to talk about it?" And I can understand how they're feeling, that pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization. And if you can understand what that means without looking it up, you belong here. Okay? And, you know, because I was in that thing when I came in here. And do the steps, you know, because they're the ones that are going to help you get through all that stuff and learn how to live life on life's terms, because we're not born with a book. It tells us how to live life on life's terms. You know, every time I had a problem, I drank. Every time I had a success, I drank. That's what I know how to do best, is drink. And today I don't have to do that. You know, I can live life on life's terms today, and I'm truly thankful to you people and to God, you know, because I didn't have a God when I came in here, and I do now. See, I don't, I'm not alone anymore. I can be lonely, but I'm not alone. I don't have to walk through all the stuff that I walk through alone. And my God's always with me, and He's never ever failed me, and He will never ever fail you. If you just get a God of your understanding, you know, and just live the program. Just don't leave. Just don't leave. You don't have to come back. Because there's people that go out and they don't come back. They die. You know, what do you tell their children? You know, and you know, I don't want to have somebody come to me and say, you know, your daddy went out and he drank, you know, and he died. And you know, because I want to live today. And just welcome home to the newcomers. Thanks for letting me share.
It's TJP.
Good evening, everyone. My name is TJ, and I am an alcoholic. And I need to let you know that I'm in sheer terror right now. Not just fear. My home group is Saturday Night Live, and this is the first speaker meeting that I've done in my sobriety. And it's a real honor to be up here, and it's also very scary for me. I want to welcome the newcomers here tonight. I know one of the hardest things that I've ever done in my life was to come into these rooms and stand up and introduce myself as an alcoholic. The words kind of choked out, and it was very difficult. I'm here tonight to share with you a little bit about what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like for me today. And my sobriety date is November 16th, 1983. And I have a little over 8 years of sobriety, and what I can tell you right off the bat is my time in sobriety has been a lot more interesting than my time out there. As soon as my heart stops pounding, you know, what was real overwhelming for me is I'm in a process right now where there's some stuff going on in my life, and I'm in the process of having to make a spiritual decision. And what that means for me is that I don't go spiritual matters alone, and I seek counsel, and I go to God, and I make a decision. And I'm in a process right now that has a profound effect on my life. And so I've been thinking about that a lot in the last few days, and it's kind of given me a reprieve from having to dwell on, oh my God, I have to do a speaker meeting Friday night. So that's been kind of nice. But today I was sitting at home before this meeting, and I was doing some praying. One of the girls I sponsor, Debbie, came over, and we spent a couple hours together talking and laughing and sharing with each other, and I got the book out, and we did some quiet time and we prayed. And prior to that, when I got home from work, when I was at work, I got some phone calls today from some people in this fellowship calling to tell me that they love me and that they'll see me here tonight and they support me. And when I got home today, there was at least 4 messages on my machine saying the same thing. And as those messages were playing back, I got these goosebumps that went through my whole body, and it was like, God, I cannot believe how powerful God is and how powerful the love of the people in this fellowship are. It was overwhelming to me that the person that I used to be could now have so many people in my life that just love me and support me, and people that I can love and support. It just blew my mind. It really did. It was just really neat. A little bit about where I come from. Well, first of all, I'm full-blooded Italian, so right from the gate, the potential for alcoholism is pretty high. You know, I don't remember this, but my parents have shared with me that my nonno, which is grandfather in Italian, used to feed me Dago red wine when I was in the high chair. I don't remember that. I sometimes wish I did. But the earliest recollection that I have as a child is I remember I was alone a lot when I was young. My parents, I'm the youngest of 4 children, and the next oldest from me, there's a 9-year gap. And the oldest in my family, there's a 19-year gap. So I was like not planned. And so I was basically an only child for a long time. But I can remember, you know, my parents, by the time I came along, they had to both go out and work to earn a living. And so I was shuffled off to a lot of babysitters. And my first recollection of my childhood was at about the age of 4 years old. And to recollect what I know that happened in that time frame was I was molested. And this is something that I did not remember until I got sober. I learned early on, at the age of four, that I don't like this planet, I don't like these feelings, and that I can't trust anybody. You know, I started learning that real early on. I was a real loner growing up. I remember that, and I was talking to Debbie, and I tuned in on this feeling that I had, like around 5 years old. I can remember it was a real stormy, windy day, and I was at the neighbor's house by myself, as usual, and I had this umbrella, and I guess I had just gotten finished watching Mary Poppins, and I kept jumping off this little brick wall with this umbrella, just wishing so bad that the wind would just pick me up and carry me away, and that I wouldn't have to come back to this life and be on this planet anymore. I didn't want to do it. I lived in Menlo Park at that time. I was born and raised in Menlo Park. And when I was about 7 years old, my dad purchased a liquor store down here in San Jose. Isn't that convenient? So my next oldest sister and I and my parents packed up and moved down to San Jose in the Rose Garden area. And the other two kids were already moved out. They kind of hard to even think of them as brothers and sisters because for me they were never, we didn't live in the same house. So we moved down to the Rose Garden area, and the only recollection I have of that time is one more time, you know, put in a new school. I was alone one more time, scared, 8 years old, shuffled off to another babysitter. My sister, I was like the only person I had, and she was involved with someone, and my parents hated him, and she went off and got pregnant. And I can remember one night she tried to take a lot of pills and end her life because my parents told her, you can't be with this man. And I just remember being in my bedroom thinking, God, make them stop yelling at each other. She's the only thing I have. Don't take her too. And she left. She went off with this man and got married, and they lived happily ever after, which is rare. But so that left me. That left me, my mom, and my dad, who was always working. My dad was never there because he owned his own business and was always at work. What happened at this time was the message that I got from my mom was, okay, TJ, you're it. You are my godchild. You are the child that God sent me. You are going to be the perfect child, the one that's going to do it right. You're going to take piano lessons and get straight A's, and you're going to get married and then have a baby and do everything right. Not like she did, not like my sisters did, who all went out and did it the wrong way, dropped out of school, got pregnant, maybe got married. What I remember her telling me at 8 years old was, you are my reason for living. You are the only reason I am alive, and you are the only reason I come home at night. If you were not in my life, I wouldn't even want to be alive. At that moment, I knew the only thing that I could at 8 years old, that is, it's my job to take care of my mom now. If I'm her reason for living, that means it's my job. I'll have to be the mom. What happened after that was I was, like I said before, shuffled off to another babysitter, and one more time, molested again. One more time, reaffirmed, screw people, can't trust them. You know, at this point, I didn't like my dad, didn't like my mom, didn't like men, didn't like women. And, you know, that's a really young age to have all these opinions formed already, 8 years old. A year later, my brother and his wife lived in Wyoming, and my parents decided, wouldn't it be nice to send TJ to Wyoming for the summer to live with her, to stay with her brother and his wife. This was my first experience with getting high. At 9 years old, I'm going to get on this airplane and go to Denver, Colorado to be picked up by my brother to go to drive to Laramie, Wyoming. And I had to fly alone. And my mom knew that I was very nervous. So what I watched her do was go to her cabinet, open it up, and there was all these bottles up there. And she took one out. She said, "This is a tranquilizer, honey. I'm going to cut it in half for you, and I'm going to give this to you, and this is going to make you feel better, and it's going to get you through this scary experience." And she gave me this pill, and I remember, wow, I like this. God, 9 years old, man, I like this feeling. I can do life if I can feel like this. And that was my first experience with a chemical inside my body. You know, around the age of 9 and 10, a lot of people in my family were starting to get married. I mean, I have like thousands of cousins, you know, Italians. They just keep reproducing everywhere. So we were always going to this, and they're always real big to-dos and real big occasions. And I remember around the age of 10, you know, me and all my little cousins, we'd be at these weddings and we'd steal bottles of champagne and we'd go out behind the church and just get drunk. And it was, this is good stuff, you know. I'm drinking, you know, I remember the first time I put alcohol in me and it hit bottom. It was that ah feeling, you know, like David talks about, that ah feeling. And I felt like something inside me came alive and I didn't have to isolate and be alone anymore. I could be a part of the little cliques that were going on. And I remember one wedding that I almost really blew it because I got too drunk, and there was this like 5-tiered wedding cake, and I was so drunk at 10 years old I slipped and fell and almost knocked this cake over, and all the people are standing around trying to juggle and save this cake from falling. And you know, that when you're 10 years old, all the adults are kind of standing around thinking, oh, isn't that cute, you know, look at her, she's drunk. Needless to say, I don't know if I was an alcoholic at 10 years old, but that, I have a recollection of the first time I got drunk. You know, I went through school as a very good student. You know, I managed to slide all the way through school until junior high school as an honor roll student and made mom and dad real proud, and they had all the ceremonies, and I have all the little plaques and all that good stuff. And I hit ninth grade, and you know, throughout all this process, I was still a loner. You know, I still didn't trust anybody. I didn't want to be a part of any cliques. And, you know, I just like, you know, leave me alone and let me just take, well, the piano lessons turned into organ lessons, but that's okay. So I did that gig, and I, you know, was a bookworm, and I was in the choir. And, you know, I hit the ninth grade, and I finally just, I don't know what happened. I just decided, you know what, screw this. Just screw this. I'm tired of being alone. I don't like the way I feel. I don't want to be on this planet. And I got in with a group of kids, and I started drinking. You know, I believe for me, that's when I started really drinking alcoholically, in the ninth grade. And I used to go down to the liquor stores and shoulder tap Bacardi 151. And a couple times I got stiffed. You know, you give people money to go in and buy it for you, and they come out and they split with your bottle and your money or whatever. And but there were enough times where I managed to get the alcohol that I needed, and school wasn't important anymore. I didn't care. You know, I figured that I'm going to fall off this pedestal eventually with mom and dad, so why not just help it along, you know? So I found my niche. You know, I found my bottle of Bacardi, and I had found my answer. I had found my answer. And I can remember sitting at the park down the street from the school and just down in this alcohol and not even flinching. And everyone was sitting around thinking, God, how can she do that, not even flinch? And it was just like the answer to everything for me. That's when I started becoming, you know, for me, that's when I started becoming popular, and I became a leader, and everyone started following me. It was like, hey, I'm TJ, I'm drinking, come with me, I'll show you how to do it. You know, and I started experimenting with drugs, and the end of my sophomore year, I was called into the dean's office and was politely asked to leave the school and not come back. You know, and my mom was devastated, let me tell you. I got a lot of mom issues here. But for her little girl to be kicked out of high school was not real, real good in her eyes. So what happened was my parents got together with my sister and her husband, the one with the happy marriage, and decided that I should go live with them in Cupertino so that I can get my act together. It was the crowd I was running with, see. I was hanging out with the wrong kids, you know. So I packed up my stuff and moved to Cupertino and tried to start a new life. And what happened there for me was I managed to actually go about maybe 6 months without drinking. And I wasn't into drugs very much at this point, so that wasn't a big deal for me, but it was hard to not drink. What happened in that time frame is I ended up in the hospital for almost a 3-week period, and what, you know, there was a lot of stuff going on, and I can remember overhearing conversations between my brother and my mom and my other sister and my mom. How can you, you know, ship her away, and you spoiled her rotten all her life, and you do everything for her, and, you know, I just would sit there and cry thinking, God, I didn't want to be spoiled. I just wanted to be a part of. You know, I didn't want you to buy me all these things. I just wanted you to be there. I ended up in the hospital with anorexia, you know, in my junior year when I was trying not to drink, and I had moved to another school. And I wouldn't eat for 3 weeks, and I was fed through an IV, and so I missed a lot of that first year in school and thought, well, here we go again, trying to do a new start, and here I am, another failure. So then, being anorexic and being, I got down to about 105 pounds, I decided, well, you're still too fat, and I decided to go to one of these weight clinics. And they like to give drugs there. And I got turned on to pharmaceutical whites and phenobarbitals. And I liked it. I liked it. What happened then is my mom, see, my mom's, man, she's looking at it now, it's like, this lady could be considered a drug dealer, perhaps. You know, she had a connection through a doctor where she could get whatever drug she wanted. And she got me a jar of 1,000 phendimetrazines, which are pharmaceutical whites. And I was eating up to about 40 of them a day for a 3-month span. And every third or fourth day, I'd take a bunch of phenobarbitals to try and come down. And, man, I was seeing spiders crawling walls at this point. This wasn't happening. I was in a relationship with a guy I met in Cupertino. Of course, I had to find a new man. You know, that's always going to fix me. And this gentleman liked to smoke pot. Well, I wasn't into pot. I liked my alcohol, and now I was liking my whites because I could stay skinny. And I can remember I would sit there with this guy and I would just say, how can you smoke that stuff? I can't believe you could put that stuff in your body, na 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 na, and just rag on this guy horribly. And I'm sitting there taking all these pills, and now my alcoholism is full blown, tilt boogie, drinking whatever I want, whenever I want, and living with my sister. My mom's not there. You know, her husband works swing shifts, so she's living her teen years with me, and we're both getting loaded all the time. I bottomed out, but not yet. Then I found other drugs, you know. I did a lot of coke, did a lot of acid, did a lot of mushrooms, did a lot of that stuff, you know. Ended up moving out with this gentleman that I started getting stoned with all the time. We moved out together. Yeah. Little did he know that I was far more progressed than he'd ever be. We moved out together. You know, I was with this man for 6 years, and I thought, this is the man I'm going to marry. I'm going to spend the rest of my life with this man. I was really convinced. You know, and we lived together for a year, and that's when he saw my disease. You know, he saw my disease in full progression, and he couldn't understand why I couldn't stop drinking, why I didn't even want to stop drinking, and why I had to stay up all night, why I was stealing money from his wallet to go buy alcohol and score drugs. And he finally left, you know, after a year. He couldn't take it anymore, and he said, the best thing I can do for you is to leave. And I was blown away, and I was devastated. It took me, after he left, I had pretty much given up on myself, you know, and I had just, my life was trashed. I had my best girlfriend move in and her boyfriend, and we just ran wild and had parties all the time, and, you know, I started having blackouts. I had a whole week span that I can't recall at all, you know, and that's real scary. I can't remember one piece of this entire week. I had weird people following me in black limousines. Just weird stuff started happening in my life, you know. Got my life threatened a few times, and some of the people I was running with were real scary and were involved in some real scary stuff. And in 1983, where I reached my bottom, actually, I'm sitting on the floor in my duplex at the time, just bottomed out. I'd come off a 4-day run. I had downed a couple bottles of tequila. I'm sitting on the floor in the living room, and what I knew at that very moment was, I don't know how not to drink. I can't go without alcohol, and I can't live with alcohol. You know, I'm screwed. I don't want to do this anymore, and I don't know how to stop. I passed the point where I have lost the power of choice. I have to drink. I don't know any other way anymore. And I can remember calling a friend in Marin, saying, "My God, I don't want to live. Please help me." You know, and he told me, "I'll come down and I'll bring some drugs, honey, and everything will be fine." And I said, "Don't bother." Where I ended up in my bottom was in a bar stool at Otto's in Los Gatos. And those of you that are laughing, I know you know what kind of place that is. And I would walk in there on occasion dressed like this, okay? And those chicks in there didn't like me too much. And I'd go in there and I'd try and look good and pick up on their guys. And, I hung out in that place for the last 4 months of my drinking, trying to seek lower companionship, not realizing that I am the lower companionship. You know, this is it. It don't get no better than this. I was so broke at this time, I had to move back home. I'd been evicted from this duplex, and I would just bring my own bottle in my purse and go in the bathroom and drink because I couldn't afford to buy the drinks, and the bartenders were getting tired of trying to help me skate, you know. That place was a trip. That place was really a trip. You know, I'm grateful today for being there. In October of 1983, my brother called me one night and said, "Sis," now this is a man that I've never had a relationship with in my life. He's never been there. He's a lot older than me. I don't even really like him. He called me up and said, "We need to talk. Can you meet me at Denny's?" So I met him down there one night in October, and he said, "You know what I need to tell you is that from what I can see, you're killing yourself. You are an alcoholic." Now, I was told this by my friends in the ninth grade, mind you, and you can guess what I told them to do with it. "You're an alcoholic and you're killing yourself, and I can't stand to watch you kill yourself. I know this lady that runs a recovery hospital. Please call this lady. Please just call her and see what she has to offer." And I said, "I'll think about it." What I found out later on is that very same day, my entire family had gathered together and gone to some alcohol and drug intervention, and they were going to try and trick me into a hospital. They were going to try and do one of those intervention type things. I'm really glad they didn't do that. I don't like to be told what to do. I don't know if any of you can relate to that. Let alone be tricked. So I went down to this hospital, and it was right up here on Winchester Boulevard here in Campbell. And I talked to this lady named Jody. And I said, "My family seems to think I might have a problem, and maybe I do, I'm not sure, but what do you got to offer?" She showed me around the place, and she talked a little bit about Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said, "Well, you know, I got a few things. I'm a singer, and I was in a rock and roll band at the time, and we had a gig lined up for Halloween. And I said, you know, I got a couple things I got to do, so I'll get back to you on it." And I went out and did that gig on Halloween, and I was so drunk, I got all the words backwards, and trying to be up there on a stage singing and falling down, it was a disaster. But what ended up happening, and this is real important for me, I had all these family members and employers, the job I had at the time, they were calling me in and saying, "You know what? We think that there's a problem here. Your job performance stinks, your attendance stinks, and we don't think it's okay that you pass out on your typewriter. It's not acceptable behavior. I think if you don't do something, you will be fired." You know, so for me, all these people were trying to tell me, "You know what, TJ, there's something wrong. You got to look at it." And none of these people had the disease of alcoholism, okay? One day in early November, I went in, and I'm going to share this with you. I went in to get my hair cut, okay? Get my hair permed. I'm a girl, you know. And I went to this guy who one of my girlfriends referred me to, and he's doing my hair, and I said, hey, why don't we do this? Why don't I go get a bottle of wine and maybe a loaf of bread and some cheese, and we'll just get a little buzz and have some fun? And he said, oh, you can go ahead and do that if you like, but I don't drink. Well, that got my attention. What do you mean you don't drink? I don't understand that. He said, I don't drink. And I got quiet for a few minutes, and then I couldn't stand it anymore. And I said, well, can you tell me, you know, why don't you drink? You know, and this gentleman proceeded to tell me that he is an alcoholic and that he has 3 years clean and sober in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I spent the next hour gathering information from this gentleman about Alcoholics Anonymous. 2 days later, I ended up in O'Connor Hospital in Campbell. What it took for me was another alcoholic to be put in my path to plant the seed and carry this message, because I started sharing things with this man that none of these other people could possibly understand the feelings that I was having, because they're not alcoholic. And that's my belief. You know, it's like God intervened and put someone in my path with the disease who's in recovery to plant the seed and carry this message. And on Wednesday, November 16th of 1983, I walked into a recovery hospital, terrified, hungover. The night before, I was in autos just thinking, my God, what's going to happen after this? You know, I think I might be an alcoholic. I know I'm hooked on cocaine, and I smoke so much pot that I forget it's even illegal. You know, 12 joints a day. You know, you just drive around, you know, 12 joints. Big deal. Everybody does that, don't they? well, I remember when I walked into this hospital, they have this sign, this wood engraved sign, and there's a lot of people in this room here to support me tonight who know this sign, and it says, through these doors walk the most beautiful people in the world. And I remember looking at that thinking, oh God, I hate myself and I feel like a piece of shit. How can you think I'm the most beautiful person in the world? Look at my life. Look at my life at 23 years old. I don't have anything. That's where my recovery started, you know. I got into this hospital, and to paint a picture of how I was when I was new, and my sponsor's in the room, and I need to be realized. I was angry, belligerent, terrified. I did not want what you people had. I did not want to be in this hospital, and I did not want to be an alcoholic. Period. And what does this mean? Does this mean that I can't ever drink again for the rest of my life? I'm only 23. My God, what if at my own wedding I can't even drink, for God's sake? You know, these are the thoughts going through my head. I can remember sitting in that hospital, you know, and I gathered a lot of information in there. And the most important piece of information I got in that place was, and is that I cannot maintain sobriety unless I come to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, for me, that was a stepping stone to get here. I don't remember ever thinking, gee, I think I'll go to Alcoholics Anonymous. But when I got out of that recovery hospital and went back to my job, I had found a meeting schedule in my desk. Evidently, in a blackout, I had called central office and said, help me, and they sent me a meeting schedule. I attended my first AA meeting in this hospital, and every Saturday they'd bring us down on 400 West Campbell to that meeting, the gratitude group. And I wasn't grateful. And they had really heavy hitters, you know. Jack H. was there every Saturday, and a gentleman named Clay, and a lot of people were there, and this Gina the God Lady. Oh, God. You know, and Gina the God Lady, we could call on at every meeting and just say how wonderful her life is now, spiritual, and God loves me, and God loves you, and sobriety is wonderful, and I wanted to puke, you know. And there was a gentleman there who was always there, and his name was Don C. He was about 6'8" and 300 pounds, and he would stand up and he'd say, I'm here to tell you people that One of you is going to stay sober, one of you is going to get drunk, and one of you is going to die. And I would sit back there like this. You son of a bitch. How dare you talk like that? It has been my experience that one out of three stays sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. I grew to love this man, Don, that I absolutely hated. My sponsor was very close to him, and this man that repulsed me, I ended up sitting in the Ginger Jar coffee shop at 2 in the morning lots of times with him and Joanna talking about Alcoholics Anonymous and God. Now, that's a transformation. You know, I started hanging out with people that I went through the hospital with, and we started networking through the whole valley. And I started going to AA. I started really going to a lot of meetings. And I went all over this place in my first 2 years of sobriety, from Los Gatos to Santa Clara to Cupertino, all over. And it's really neat because today it's like wherever I go, I know some people in these rooms. You know, I know these people on a personal level. One by one, these people I was going to meetings with were starting to drop off. About 32 of us got out of the hospital right around the same time, and to my knowledge, there's two of us left clean and sober. You know, one guy got out, and a week later, killed himself. You know, what I know is that it takes a whole lot of work to stay here. And I had what I needed to do for me when I got here was I needed to make a commitment that I was going to go about this thing with at least half the zeal that I went about drinking and drugging. You know, all it took was to go about this with just half the zeal. That's what I was told. You know, there were a lot of suggestions. And I learned early on that the definition of suggestion is a subtle command. And there were a lot of suggestions. Get a sponsor. Go to lots of meetings. Pay attention in meetings. You know, start opening yourself up and getting phone numbers and using them. And so that's what I commenced to do. Going to lots of meetings and starting to, you know, form friendships in these rooms. And I was still real scared, you know. I'm not one that opens up real easily. Even still, I have a hard time trusting. And I have a hard time picking up that phone when I'm in pain. But I did it. I remember the first sponsor that I got had about a month. Well, the first person I asked to be my sponsor, because I was like about 15 days into sobriety, was this really good looking guy. And he very gently said, "Honey, you know, I'd love to be your sponsor, but Jack's my sponsor and I can't sponsor you." So the first sponsor that I got had about a month more sobriety than me, and I stayed with this lady for about 2 months after I got out of the hospital, and that worked for a while, and then it didn't work anymore. And when I had 9 months of, not even 6 months of sobriety, I started watching. You know, we didn't have a temporary sponsor box then, I don't think. I don't remember hearing one, seeing one, whatever. So I had to pay attention to the women in this fellowship and hear what they were saying and watch what they walked. And I finally found a lady that I liked what she had to say, and I watched her walk, and I wanted what she had. And I asked her one night down at another meeting in Santa Clara, "Joanna, would you please be my sponsor? I want what you have." And she said yes. And that lady has been my sponsor ever since. You know, and for this alcoholic, that's a big deal to have someone in your life that consistently for that long. You know, this from someone who would only share little bits of me with a lot of people because I knew you all wouldn't get together and put the pieces together and know who I was. You know, this lady knows everything there is to know about me. And that's powerful. We started working the steps. You know, my first year and a half of sobriety, I came to Saturday Night Live 3 times. And I was real intimidated by this group, and I was real afraid. You know, I walked in here, and everyone was so young, and so, you know, and so was I, you know, but I just felt like, God, these are all my peers, and I'm never going to fit in. All that stuff was still there. And so I just stayed in other meetings, and that was okay. You know, I got involved with a talent show at West Valley College that certain members of Alcoholics Anonymous got together and put on, and I met my friend David, and he introduced me again to Saturday Night Live, and I went on my first retreat in sobriety at a year and a half. And at that retreat, I was absolutely rocketed into the fourth dimension, like it talks about in the book. Just rocketed. And I knew without a shadow of a doubt that there is a powerful God. See, I'd started working the steps, and I can remember sitting with Joanne on several occasions and just being so angry, and she would just be talking the book and talking God, and I didn't have a conception of a God. I had a punishing God, and I thought, I'm not going to turn my will and my life over to a punishing God. How can I do that? And she said, you know what, let me share with you what my God looks like. And so she did, and I said, I want your God. She said, well, borrow my God until you come up with your own. And so that's what I did. And then we did the third step prayer together. You know, and then I started in on the process of the inventory and through the process of the steps. And, you know, and we agnostics, at the end of the chapter, it talks about he disclosed himself to us when we grew near to him. And it says he comes to all who seek him. And what that tells me is that it's my responsibility to seek God. He's there waiting for me. And that's what happened through the process of the steps for me. And Joanna said, your relationship with God will grow as you continue to work these steps. Just keep on going. And that's exactly what's happened. And at this retreat I went to, it just blew me out of the water. And I just thought, wow, man, this thing's for real. My life is changing. And I can't believe, you know, my first 30 days, I couldn't believe I had a drink. And now I'm thinking, my God, how have I done this without drinking or taking anything? And when I'm left to my own devices, I can't not drink. You know, I am powerless over alcohol. There's a power greater than alcohol and a power greater than me, and that power is God. And I know that today. My sobriety has been a trip, you know. I came to Saturday Night Live after that retreat because I bonded with people in this group and I felt a kinship with these people. And that was when I had a year and a half of sobriety, and I've been coming to this group ever since regularly, and I'm accountable for, and I show up here on a regular basis. And those of you who also do that know who I am today. You pretty much know who I am. And there's been a lot of growth in sobriety. My whole entire... It talks about in the doctor's opinion that I read early on in sobriety. My sponsor said, read the doctor's opinion. You will get so much information. You know, read the whole 164 pages, but the doctor's opinion. And it says in there, in order to stay sober, I must undergo a complete entire psychic change. And that has happened for me in Alcoholics Anonymous. I couldn't be standing here clean and sober if that hasn't happened for me. I've gone through a lot of things in sobriety. You know, I have felt the most joy I've ever felt in my life, and I've felt intense pain in sobriety, and I've walked through it. You know, I believe that I can walk through anything and stay sober, and I don't just... I believe that because I've done it. I believe that because I've done it. I've gone through... I've had a couple relationships in sobriety, and I spent 3 years with a gentleman and knew that it was time for it to end, and did a lot of writing and praying and ended that and went right back into another relationship. And this is all in the last 2 years now. I entered into an extremely abusive, mentally and physically abusive relationship. And on both ends. And I thought, you know what, well, if this is the best I can get, I'm just going to take it. That's what I thought. And so I stayed in this relationship, and on September 8th of 1990, I got to walk through a huge emotional displacement. And this is a real important part of my story now, because I know I can stay sober no matter what. On that day, I got a call from a girl that I sponsor, and she said, I need you to come with me. I need to go over to our friend's house, a gentleman in this program. And we got there, and we had found that he had been drinking. And through a process and series of events, what the ultimate act was is that I stood there and watched this gentleman load a gun, put it in his mouth, and blow his brains out. Okay? This gentleman was drunk, first of all, and what I believe is that alcoholism killed him. I do not believe that suicide is an option. I believe I took that third step, and suicide is not an option. My will in my life is God's, and God abhors suicide. What happened for me in a split second when that trigger went off is I knew right then, right there, either God is everything or He is nothing, because there is no way I can get through this if He is not here right now. You know, and Debbie and I were there together. And what happened was we called a friend to come over, a gentleman who has a long time in this fellowship and who has experience, strength, and hope in this area. And he came there and he started pumping us full of God stuff and telling us something good will happen as a result of this. And through the next couple months, you know, we were in shock, complete shock. The love of this fellowship consumed us. We walked into a meeting at 8 o'clock the next morning on a Sunday, and just the fellowship just swooped us up in its arms and said, "Don't worry about a thing, you girls. We'll take care of you. And God works through people, and God took care of us." We were fed. We had roofs over our heads. We had beds to sleep in. We had stuffed animals to sleep with. We had it all. You know, we had it all. And we had, you know, and I know I can speak for Debbie because we shared this with each other. We had huge emotional displacement where everything we thought and believed had changed that fast. That fast. And in the next few weeks, all kinds of weird things were happening. These really neat spiritual experiences. That's all I can say. It was like all these God things. Oh, my God, did you feel that? And just incredible spiritual awakenings were happening, and you know, we were just left wide open, and Alcoholics Anonymous was so powerful, and God was so powerful, and how could something so horrible and ugly, how could there be good coming out of this? And there has been. It has completely turned my life around. What happened was the relationship that I was in ended like that because I couldn't, in shock, go back to an addictive, physically abusive, all that crap. I couldn't go back. It wasn't safe. 2 months later, I was back in that relationship. I was addicted to the relationship the same way I was addicted to alcohol. And it took me a while to see that. You know, I had to treat that relationship just like my alcoholism. And things just got worse. In June of 91, which was 9 months ago, I hit an emotional bottom in sobriety, and I could not handle life anymore. I couldn't. Everything came crashing in. This relationship I was in, all this, I lost it, and I ended up in the fetal position, and I reached out and made a phone call to my friend Gary, who ran O'Connor Hospital, who now moved over to Forest Avenue, and I said, "You know what, I just need a friend. I need someone to talk to. I'm losing my mind. I can't function anymore." He said, "Come on up. We'll talk." Well, I never left. I stayed for 30 days. Okay, they have and I can say this today, they have a relapse prevention program there that I'm eternally grateful for. What it took for me was to reach out and gather more tools and to gather more information, and I needed a safe place to be. I needed a safe place to be. And they made that place safe for me, and they kept the people that weren't safe away so that I could gather up the tools that I needed to regroup and so I could function in society again. I'm willing to go to any length to stay sober. I am totally willing to do whatever it takes to stay sober. And my book tells me to make use of the professionals, and then if I need to seek outside help, that's okay. Alcoholics Anonymous comes first with me. But there have been times where I have needed more help. You know, when I got to gather a lot more information, I left that hospital and I was able, finally, through another process of breakup and get back together, finally come from a place not of anger, but from a place of love for myself and finally end this abusive relationship. But it took me coming from a place of love, because God is love and I need to come from love. And my life is good. You know what? Through everything that's happened, I wouldn't trade what I have in my life today. It's the best life I've ever had. Even through all the things that have happened, even through the deaths, and I've watched people lose their fathers and their mothers, and people die, and people kill themselves, and you know what? God is so powerful, He pulls us all together, and there's a bond, there's a fellowship here. I wouldn't trade my life in Alcoholics Anonymous for anything. I've never felt such a part of, so loved. And you people said, let us love you until you can learn to love yourself. And that has been, today I love myself. And as a result, I get to turn around and I get to love you. I get to learn how to be a friend today. I can be there to help when maybe no one else can. You know, one alcoholic working with another alcoholic. You know what? I think this is pretty impressive. There are five generations in this room here tonight, and that impresses me. Joanna is my sponsor. I sponsor Debbie. Debbie sponsors Val, and Val sponsors Silvana. And we're all here in this room tonight. That's intense. There's a network here. You know, to coin a phrase of a man that I love with all my heart, I am impressed by the things that I do. And it's all a result of God and Alcoholics Anonymous. If you're new in this room tonight, I want to welcome you with all my heart. And I want to tell you that you may think I'm lying, but I really do understand the feelings, the terror, the fear, the anger, the resentment. I felt all those same things. And I don't have that today. You know, the steps have completely changed my life. God has completely changed my life. You know, just when you think it can't get any better, it does. Just when you think this is the worst, it's just never going to be okay, it's okay. I've learned how to match calamity with serenity in everything that happens. You know, I work at Lockheed, and I work with an awesome group of girls, and you know, this is a trip. I mean, I'm the only alcoholic in the office, and you know what's going on now is I share who I am with people in my life. I share with them who I am and what I'm about, and as a result, I've got to do a lot of 12-step work, and I've gotten to talk to spouses and take spouses to Al-Anon meetings, and I work with a lot of people in recovery, and I've got to watch people in recovery be out there and just kind of sit back and very gently carry this message and be a pro and be attraction rather than promotion and be a good example of Alcoholics Anonymous. And there's a lady in this room here tonight that I watched out there for years, and she's clean and sober 2+ years in Alcoholics Anonymous. And to watch that, you know, the girls I work with are all normies in my little office, and pretty much on a regular basis every morning we sit together and read the Daily Word, a little meditation book. I mean, that is a miracle. You know, it's like, who wants to read the little Denise? Who wants to read the Daily Word today? Teach, get the Daily Word out. It's like, you know, I can be an example, and I can practice these principles in all my affairs. You know, that's what it tells me. I have to practice these principles in all my affairs, not just in here, but everywhere I go. I get to be an example of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I get to love my brothers. You know, we're all spiritually equal, and I get to love my brothers. I want to welcome everyone here tonight. I want to thank God for Alcoholics Anonymous, and I want to thank Alcoholics Anonymous for God. And God bless you all. Thank you.